only question that I have for you is, can you point at the most common place where Mariposa used?
Yeah. You can't get a horizontally polarized antenna high enough on low frequencies. So people use vertical polarization. They use ground planes, four squares, monopoles, 160 and 80 over.
And what is the most common application for monopole antennas?
Once again, on 160 meters, to have an antenna up ahead, a horizontal antenna up ahead wavelength, that means it has to be 80 meters high. It means it has to be 240 feet high. Do you know anybody that's got their beam at 240 feet? I don't.
I understand. No, I was just asking, because I had in mind automotive radios and broadcast transmitters, and I wanted to know if you agree with that.
Oh, yeah. Well, all the AM broadcast stations use monopoles. They're all in New Jersey, in the Meadowlands. They all use vertical polarization.
And every car in the past was using a piece of telescopic wire, and it was a monopole antenna as well. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. But once again, are we talking about a practical application, or are we writing a book?
No, I understand. You are a practical person. I do admire that from you, and I do thank you very much for your input in this area. Now, dipole antennas versus long wire antenna. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, it sort of depends on the individual. It certainly is easier to string a NFET. You have two connections. The problem with that is you have to deal with a counterpoise, or else nature gives you a counterpoise in your transmission line going into your radio. And you need an antenna tuner because you're generally not built to be resonant. If it was a half wave, a perfect half wave NFET, and you had something like a 49-to-1 balance, you might get away without an antenna tuner if you stayed on that halfway frequency, but otherwise you're going to need some kind of impedance matching device to get around it. But you know, some people love NFETs and other people like dipoles.
You're too busy?
Yes, Rich.
Isn't it true that on the low bands you want to try to stay horizontal unless you must go to a vertical? I know people use verticals for listening antennas, but in terms of transmitting antennas, don't you want at all costs to stay horizontal on the low bands?
Well, you have problems. Let me just make sure that I have it. Oh, okay. You have problems. It's like anything. It's a complicated situation. People tend to say that verticals are noisier. And they pick up a lot of background local noise. So on that account, they suggest horizontally oriented antennas have less of that problem. But as Alan has mentioned, vertical and horizontal antennas have a lot of problems getting out, depending upon how high you could mount them. You have to mount them at least half a wavelength off the ground, otherwise you'll get ground coupling, and rather than a good takeoff angle, you'll have a near vertical incident sky wave going straight up. So there are some factors favoring a vertical and some factors favoring a horizontal, and that's probably why there's a lot of people out there using sort of slopers these days.
And 2KW.
Yes, Alan.
You know, I always believed that as a city boy. I always believed that verticals were noisier. And in the city, they are, because the city's pretty noisy. And verticals pick up noise equally well from all directions. But I operate from K1TTT from the superstation. and we have a four square. It's quieter than the beam. It's as quiet as it can be, and it's vertically polarized. It completely changed my mind about polarity. It opens and closes the band, and he has some incredible horizontal antennas there, very, very high.
Okay, I mean, like all things, none of this is written in stone, and none of the theoretical constructs are 100% real-life situations. There used to be a story that Dick K2RAW used to tell of a gentleman who basically had a piece of wire on the ground that defies anyone's idea of how a good radiating antenna should work, and yet he made a lot of contact with it. So I'm sure there are situations where there are vertically oriented antennas that have less background noise problem than horizontal, especially since almost everyone I'm talking to tonight is in an urban environment, and we all kind of hopefully agree that in the urban environment, verticals are noisier. We have to deal with where we are. It's, you know, it's not like we could move to Hawaii next week.
Well, I'll tell you one good solution for cliff dwellers, and it's really easy on the pocketbook as well. Sethic used to call a delta loop a self-contained vertical, SCV, because it didn't require a separate ground. You just put up a delta loop. It requires a single high support. You feed it at one of the lower corners. Do not feed it at the top. Feed it at one of the lower corners. It will be vertically polarized. It's a very quiet antenna and a good DX antenna and costs almost nothing.
Okay, but for the low frequencies, a lot of people's real estate probably couldn't handle it.
You can make your one wavelength loop any shape you like, and you can convolute it around the smallest lot. Over.
I agree with Alan. I once had an antenna like that. It was the best DX antenna I ever had. Very low noise.
Okay. Loops are good. Again, there's a lot. You know, I mean, a lot of New York lots are basically 100 square feet. And can you do it somehow? I guess theoretically, where there's a will, there's a way. But it's not something that is kind of obvious. You know, I mean, I have a 20-foot by 25-foot backyard. I don't know how you would twist that and turn it into an 80-meter delta loop.
Well, from the chimney down to the rear left corner, across the fence to the rear right corner, and back up to the chimney. If that's not long enough, then down the sides before it goes up to the chimney. You can fit a loop. Guaranteed you can.
Okay. Wesley, anything else?
Yeah. Just two questions more. I don't want to hold this too long. Although I have another question apart from that, but that's from the science section. I assume that there was not so many people who were eager to talk today, and that's why I used this for myself. Let me jump. So we have a dipole antenna versus long wire. What would be the difference between them, and what would be the benefit? What do you think about it? For HF and 30, up to 30 megahertz, and to XGN.
Well, once again, a dipole is a balanced antenna. You do not have to worry about a counterpoise with proper balance. You don't have to worry too much about common modes getting back into your shack, as opposed to an NFES long wire. If you operate on the resonant portion of the dipole, you don't need an antenna tuner. If you're just going to use a random NFES, you're pretty much going to have to use an antenna tuner to resonate it for most of the frequencies that you're interested in. But you could theoretically do the sort of same thing with a doublet. The difference usually in the English language between a doublet and a dipole is a dipole usually is a resonant a two-legged antenna. A doublet is a not necessarily resonant, two-legged antenna. And usually it's fed with open line so that any reflections are lessened. And then it feeds into a very nice antenna tuner. And you tune the doublet to resonance using the antenna tuner. And there are people who love that. So that's sort of a dipole version of a random NFET, and you don't have to worry too much about counterpoise, balancing, and common mode as much.
Maybe Alan can add us some more information about long piece of wire. There is something that a piece of wire has to have, grounding. But the question is, are we grinding just one piece of wire, or the long wire, one end, or two ends of it? Enter XGN.
You could use as many wires as you want to make a counterpoise. Usually people use one. You could use two, you could use 10, you could use 20. I've never really heard where an antenna failed because it had too much counterpoise.
My understanding is, maybe I didn't word myself properly. The long wires are only effective if you ground them somehow to make sure they receive signals, either by grounding at both ends and F rod or connecting directly into receiver. Do you agree with that?
I am not quite sure what you're alluding to. An NFET, usually the counterpoise is applied at the 9-to-1 balance on one end. You can't ground the end wire itself. Otherwise, if you ground it, you get no RF. So it's a counterpoise attached to the other lead to the transmission line that has to have either a counterpoise, or you can call it a ground and it's really a counterpoise, but I don't understand how you would want to counterpoise two ends of the same antenna.
Okay, let me say how I understand the long wire antenna. It's a device, right? Built from a wire that has a certain length. It could be copper or aluminum. It is simply a straight piece of wire, but doesn't have to be a wire. It could be a metal. And it's simplest form, there's nothing else than that. But of course, you can connect one end of that wire, it has to be grounded. One end of that wire you connect to the ground, and the other end you can connect to your radio. But you can do it a different way. You can cut them on half and ground one piece of wire and connect to your ground of your radio, and take the other piece of the wire, ground it, and connect it to the middle of it. And you have an absolutely amazing antenna. A basic design is usually used for HF frequencies up to 30 megahertz, but if you have some extra time on your hands, you may perform better using it at other frequencies ranges, but you have to know the dimension of the length of the wire. And to XGN.
Okay, I don't know anything about it. I have to look it up. Usually, if you ground a single piece of wire, the only difference is you're kind of vaguely talking about things that sort of sound like beverage antennas, which are not exactly what you're describing, and they work on a different principle, but I'm not quite sure what type of antenna you're talking about right now.
It is being called long wire antenna. Long wire antenna, but you can use in a search engine grounded antenna, ham radio grounded antenna. Maybe you can find it. I can recall, because I'm talking from my head, I can recall the picture. There was a ham radio operator drawn on the piece of paper, and there was a piece of wire that was hanging on some kind of bushes, going all the way about 50 feet or so, and then it was grounded at the end of it. And then there was another piece of wire going in different direction, hanging on some kind of bushes, and it was grounded. And both of them were connected to the radio. Great reception. Maybe our friend, professional with antennas, would add a few words about it. 10-2-XGN.
ACTPL?
Yes, yes.
I'm not a professional on antennas, but that is not a long wire antenna. A long wire antenna is just a long piece of wire, which is not related to any particular half wavelength, and is usually fed with a balun. What Wesley's talking about is something completely different.
I was talking about long wire antenna. The long wire antenna could be used as a piece of wire, but has to be grounded. And I can send to Dr. Roy a literature about it. It takes me a few minutes.
AC2PO.
Yes, Jeff.
The term long wire or random wire is very specific. Wesley, you're talking about something else, which has a piece of wire which is long, but that's not what the antenna, the type of antenna that Dr. Roy is talking about. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I think he's talking about a line of grounded antennas that basically treat the ground as the radial portion of a quarter wave ground plane. That's the closest that I could figure out that uses that. I mean, again, if you go to things like Beveridge antennas are basically, there's a loading resistor that then goes to ground. And then at the receiver end, the wire goes into the center feed, and a ground connection completes that circuit. But that's a different kettle of fish as well.
Hey, 2PC?
Yes, Rich.
You 2PC?
Yes, Rich, please.
On a different subject of antennas, but antennas nonetheless. What makes an antenna high Q, and why are magnetic loops high Q?
Okay, it has to do with relative inductance and capacitance. As you mechanically shorten an antenna, its Q goes higher and higher and higher, and that's the reason why magnetic loops are usually about a tenth of the length. The circumference is about a tenth to a third of the length of the wavelength that you're interested in. So as you shorten the antenna, you increase the Q of that resonant circuit that you're producing. When it finally does resonate, it has a very high Q value. Yes, Alan.
I thought that Q was the proportion between resistance and inductance in any circuit.
WB2EAV.
Dr. Roy, thank you the literature about it and the exact term that I used for the long wire antenna.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
There are formulas for Q about the ratio of inductance and resistance and all that, but the key point is with antenna, the Q is the operating bandwidth. When you start going to shorter and shorter antennas, they become more and more critical, and the same frequency change will raise the SWR much higher than a high Q antenna.
Yeah, I mean, in Dick's day, he had at least five different descriptions for Q. They were all appropriate. They were all accurate. It's a value that has a lot of implication.
And 2KW?
Yes, Alan.
A high Q circuit having a narrower 3 dB bandwidth is absolutely correct in all circumstances. However, it's not, Q is not defined by the narrowness of the circuit. Q is defined by the ratio between inductance and resistance, and the narrow bandwidth is a result of that. Over.
If you go through the math, the one defines the other. They're intimately related.
Yes, I would tend to agree with that. Well, once again, Alan, you are perfectly right. But the consequences of the Q, the characteristics that the value gives people insight into is operates on many, many different aspects of an operating antenna. The voltage spikes at the edges are affected by the Q, its bandwidth is affected by the Q. And yes, it's also a function of the resistance versus the inductance of the circuit.
Yeah, and the narrowness of the filter and on and on and on. It's absolutely correct. The tuned circuit.
Q factor defines damping of a resonator. Do you agree with that?
I didn't understand that. Could you repeat yourself, please?
Q factor defines the damping of a resonator. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that is one of the laundry list of things that are related to the Q of a circuit. Like I said, I can recall science six or seven explanations that Dick gave. I'm sure there's twice as many if you go into an EE book.
Can I throw a monkey wrench in the works?
Feel free, Ed. I would love you to hurl a monkey wrench.
For low frequencies especially, there are a family of active filters, two-pole active filters using operational amplifiers, resistors, and capacitors. And there are formulas that will tell you the resonant frequency and the Q without a single inductor. Now, is that a special case? Yes, but if we're, if we're just looking to be ornery and difficult, there's your answer.
Okay, very good, Ed. And why not be ornery?
Why be difficult when you try a little and be impossible? By the way, the Chebyshev filter design I was talking about a week or two ago involved multiple two-pole active filters. There wasn't an inductor in the batch.
Okay, very good. No one said you had to use inductors for a given filter design, but that's a good point to make.
Yeah, usually yes, but I'm saying it is not an absolute. There are exceptions.
Yep, I agree. So, I guess, Wesley, anything else?
Yes, I think you... There are two things. You can go to Grand Dipole. Grand Dipole is in Wikipedia, and it gives you the dipole that has two ends grounded. And this is used by U.S. Navy in Wisconsin. It was used since 1982. And the second thing, I gave you exact quote for the question by the gentleman, form of the descriptor that I use. And he objected that this is not a long wire. It's in your email right now. And to extract it. And for the grounded dipole, go to Wikipedia and type grounded dipole. I'm sorry, grounded dipole, G-R-U-N-D dipole.
Okay, well, once again, Wesley, my assumption is you read this before the technical med, because you appear to have gotten a lot of topic from it. Again, unfortunately, I feel as though I'm failing you people by not being able to simultaneously run a net, talk, listen, and breathe simultaneously all in one. So I'm sorry. I'll get fitted for another brain, so I'll be able to multiplex. But I don't know what to tell you guys. Are there esoteric grounded antennas? Apparently, yeah. Apparently, there's some aspects of them using the ground as a radial system in addition to what's usually used. Are they well known by us hams? Not as far as I'm aware. They are probably somewhat esoteric and used for special purposes. But, you know, it's not like anyone really out there has an antenna where part of the radiator is in the ground, at least listening right now. But if there is someone who wants to be contrary, please feel free to volunteer that information.
I have a cork of WBT.
Okay, Ed?
Back in the 60s, QST had an article about a buried antenna. Now, this was an April Fool's joke. There's no two ways about it. It was an April Fool's joke. But the way the article went is, they talked about if you have an antenna above ground, you get a mirror image as if part of the antenna was below ground. So this extrapolates to burying the antenna underground so the mirror image appears above the ground.
Great explanation. Thank you.
You know, I think I would kind of notice that it was an April Fool's article rather quickly. But, you know, I mean, there sort of are kind of versions that have the same weird logic, like slot antennas. You know, a slot antenna is the absence of an insulator, operates as a radiating antenna, a plane of conducting material with the pattern of a radiating antenna punched out of the sheet of metal will receive and transmit RF signals.
AF2P.
Yes, AF2P.
In the service, there was an underground antenna 3 feet deep, and it was supposed to, in theory, could survive a direct nuclear hit. Fort Ritchie, Maryland.
Okay, that's interesting. Do you have any idea what kind of soil conditions that was? Were they particularly poor as far as conductivity? Were they granite as opposed to sand and such?
Nope, I have no idea. I'm giving you information I was told. I did not observe it directly. I worked on the transmitter that fed into that antenna, but there's all kinds of secret crap, you know, that you can't reveal. But in any event, I'm telling you as much as I know about it, and I never did actually see the damn thing.
Yes, Wesley recognized. 1 second. Obviously, you could read a lot of stories of people who like to bury their radials rather than, you know, having them sit on the top of their topsoil. They'll put it a couple of inches under the topsoil. But a completely ground-oriented antenna. I don't know how that would work unless, of course, as I mentioned, it's the soil was really awful as far as high resistance material. But Wesley, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, about the ground base antenna, grounded long wire antenna. But first, one word about that what I sent you. It's not the article that we talk about. We talk about a certain phrase from the article. The long wire is only affected if ground them somehow to make they receive signals either by grounding at both ends with the earth rod or rod or connecting directly into the receiver. So that you have that phrase, you have directly in your email. Now, as far as the ground dipole, it's nothing new about it. It is known from 1875, if I remember correctly, and it is just either completely buried wire at low frequency. You got to understand that the history of the radio was starting on very, very, very low frequencies of 5 kilohertz, 10 kilohertz, 50 kilohertz, and whatsoever. And in Wikipedia, when you type ground dipole, it says in radio communication, I'm quoting, ground dipole is also referred as an earth dipole antenna, transmission-like antenna. And in technical literature, it's a horizontal tall electric dipole. HED is a huge specialized type of radio antenna that radiates extremely low frequency, ELF. So probably the nature of confusion was because I had in mind talking about the long wire antennas, the extremely low frequency or ELF antennas were what is actually a special interest to me. Back to you.
Okay, so that kind of clears up a lot of things. In the good old days, the Navy thought that 160 meters and above were worthless. All the action was on the low end of the RF spectrum. So it's understandable that a lot of early work was low frequency, and low frequency operates somewhat curiously different than high frequency, so there might be some benefit. It might have a long history, but in practical approaches for modern amateur radio, where not even that many people operate still at 160 meters, it's probably more incidental and footnote worthy than anything else. So again, I say that in practical terms for our fellow amateur radio operators, unless there's a few loafers out there who are really deeply into low frequencies, this is more of an esoteric, theoretical kind of a thing rather than, how do I put up a grounded antenna?
That's your KW.
Med scientist time.
Okay, you two were doubling, first Alan and then Ed.
Okay, the Navy still uses ELF, but that's because they found it's the only frequency that the submarines underneath the polar ice cap can receive, and they send very, very slow, and the entire state of Michigan is an antenna. The entire state of Michigan is buried. They got a transmitter at Great Lakes Naval Base, and that talks to the subs underneath the polar ice cap, and that's what we use ELF for, over.
Okay, very good, Alan. It was my understanding, though, that the Navy was moving away from that, and that's why the FCC has been much more open with amateurs using those types of frequencies lately. Someone mentioned that they would be interested in hearing about the latest, greatest technology that the Navy uses for their submarine communications, and I hazarded a guess that it's probably locked away in a high security filing cabinet. But Ed, you wanted to say something.
Yes. Regarding a real world buried antenna, I think I know what it could be. You dig a trench, you metal line it with some kind of maybe like a parabolic reflector, with a long wire antenna running down like a long, parabolic shape. Thing that's long and like focuses the energy from the antenna straight up. Then you have a dielectric lens, which is a dielectric material that kind of works sort of like an optical lens to diffuse the energy from going straight up out to the sides. And that could give you halfway decent radiation, would be literally bomb-proof. And it would work halfway decently, but it would cost God knows how many billions of dollars.
You gotta love the military. Geez, do they have deep pockets. Yeah, Well, yeah, I mean, theoretically, you can construct all kinds of interesting things. You could basically just build a bomb-proof radiating antenna just under the ground, shielded from ground currents. You know, I guess it'll be bomb-proof then also. So that sounds fascinating. I wonder if there's any kind of literature on that or just kind of tales told, you know, at a bar regularly.
You realize I'm just guessing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, there are more than a few military technological secrets that aren't really important enough to have people spill the beans, because most people don't really care about those beans, you know, like, you know, who killed JFK or whatever type of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of technical solutions, unfortunately, that none of us are going to hear about because they were done under security at the time, and no one bothered to release the material when it was no longer required by security measures.
B2BZ?
Yes, Rich.
The reason Marconi and the government chose Long Island in the early days of radio, you know, as the place to experiment was the long runs for antennas. And if I'm pretty sure that they had antennas that were longer than a mile buried underground. And I guess it was also the soil out here, you know, the sandy soil out here that attracted them. But Long Island is not given its due in terms of being the place where low frequency and extreme low frequency experimentation, you know, went on in the 1920s and 1930s.
Yeah, it's a famous place. I'm sure there was a whole bunch of different reasons. They wanted something near the ocean because the ocean can sort of act as a lovely little reflector. And they also were very interested in reaching Europe. So it was, you know, closer to Europe than other places possibly. So there were a whole bunch of different reasons why they picked that area.
Marconi Shack still exists, and every couple of years you hear that some radio guys are trying to raise money to keep it intact rather than demolish it. It's in front of some school out here in Suffolk County. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I've heard of that. You know, there's a lot of historic things. You know, some of them have been allowed to just kind of decay, but yeah, I hear that in the news every so often. It would be nice if they did something like that. Maybe, you know, the next time or the one after the next time, they'll actually collect enough money to do something like that.
Get your beach wage, Chris.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that a few years ago. It's very small. It's not very big. WB2AHK. Not very big. It's something like, seriously, like 8 feet by 8 feet. And it's right off by the school and just right off the street. And I don't know. It's not very impressive, but it's just a place where we have this equipment. But it's there.
Yeah, well, I mean, most of these things aren't terribly impressive. You know, they're usually thought of small. It's only after success that you can afford big edifices like Bell Labs and such, which is an amazing place. I wouldn't imagine. You know, it's always nice, though, to remember your history. I mean, I went to New York University, and every day I passed by a plaque to William Morse, who was an art professor there before, I think, he developed Morse code. Yes, yes. I forgot. Yes.
November 2, Zulu Charlie?
Yes, John.
Boy, do we have a second for a medical question?
Okay, yeah, we certainly have more than a second.
Okay, quickly, I was reading a book and came out of a book, and a lot of times there could be misinformation or kind of not clear. But in this book, they had said that the diamond, the job of the diamond, or maybe it's just one of the jobs, is that as the natural killer cells of the immune system pass through, the diamond checks them. And it gives it two checks. One is that it is a killer cell, that it will kill. And that the second check is that it doesn't attack the body. You know, how it does that, I'm sure, is a very complicated process. But and if either one of those tests have failed, the diamond then kills those cells. Is that your understanding? Is that, I know it's a brief, short thing. I found it fascinating. Brief, short description. But would you say that's accurate?
To a degree, but always be wary when anyone kind of simplifies the immune system. It is a ridiculously complicated system. You know, when you're paying your taxes and you look at the tax board, you think that that's complicated. It has got nothing on immunological aspects. And unfortunately, it's not a perfect system because as the years go on, we're developing a respect for a lot of autoimmune disorders, which are basically our immune system getting it very wrong and starting to attack different things in our body. Some aspects of type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disorder, rheumatoid arthritis, SLE, and you can go on and on and on and on. So that's one very small segment in a very complicated way that evolution has figured out how to play cat and mouse with viruses and bacteria and different types of parasites.
Okay, so if you agree with that statement, I've always been intrigued with autoimmune disorders, just the whole mechanisms involved with that. Has there ever been any attempts to do a thymus transplant? If that seems to be a regulator valve in some sense, has anybody ever tried a thymus transplant?
As far as I'm aware, and it's not like I've done a complete thorough research on the field, I have never read that. And there's probably a couple of good reasons. Off the top of my head, unless you get it from your identical twin, it's going to have a tissue mismatch. And you are going to have to give people anti-rejection medication to keep the thymus alive, which defeats the whole purpose of putting in the thymus.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. I was just very curious about that, you know, that statement. It sounded very intriguing and almost like a pinpoint, system. There. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's nice when articles kind of popularize different aspects, but. You know, you kind of miss the forest for the trees under some circumstances. Like, if anyone wants to give themselves a migraine, probably just doing Wikipedia of biochemistry of the chemical processes, the very well understood subset of chemical processes that go on all the time in every cell of your body, will give you a nosebleed. It is so complicated, convoluted, complex, interrelated, and it all works 24/7 because if it stopped, you'd stop running. So a lot of biology is kind of incredibly, I mean, that's nanotechnology to me. I appreciate a physicist and such building little nanite things, but really when you think about it, cells are nanites. They're molecular devices that do all kinds of things. They transcribe, they build, they break down, they recycle, all manner of things. So biology is a very interesting subject. And obviously, I found medicine interesting, too.
Yeah, and that one field, obviously, is probably the most complex, I would think. Yeah. Very interesting stuff, though.
Well, I always remember I had a car mechanic who had, car mechanics, I think there's a law. In order to be licensed, you have to have a whole bunch of silly, funny posters all over the place. And he had one that said something along the lines of, doctors only have to deal with two models, we have to deal with hundreds of different models.
As you said, there are oversimplifications.
HTPL?
Yes, Jeff.
I just encourage the other station to look up immune checkpoint. Immune checkpoint.
Okay, very good. John, did you get that? Immune checkpoint?
Yeah, what does that have to do with the Zionists, like we were talking about?
Yeah, John. Take a look at it.
Will.
Okay, this is AC2GS, by the way. It's already 9:50. Things are going well. Let me try the puzzle. Now, again, I never know how these things will work out. It'll either kind of pop within the first 2 seconds, or we might get a little bit of action on it. We'll see. So my question for tonight is, everyone remembers Dick would explain how antennas work. There's a line that was quoted only, I think, last week by John KD2BD. First you resonate, and then you radiate. So my question tonight is there a group of antennas where they're not resonant, and you aren't supposed to resonate them, but they still radiate?
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
I believe that would be the long wire, random wire.
Okay, well, in a way, yes, but in a way, no. For this particular thing, I'm going to include the entire antenna system. So it's the antenna tuner, it's the transmission line, and it's the radiating antenna. So you do still have to tune that random wire. You would kind of never really... Well, some people use it without an antenna tuner, but most people use it with an antenna tuner, and they're trying to get it to some degree of resonance. So an NFED is still designed to be a resonating standing wave antenna.
And to exchange.
Yes, Wesley.
Untrap multiband, multi-band verticals. Off-center feed dipoles. There are some compromised antennas also, but I can list them in the second round. Back to you.
Well, I'm sure you can, but they're all resonating standing wave antennas.
No, they are not. Think about non-resonant antennas. Long wires are one of the type of non-resonant antennas. There's the untrapped verticals. There were multi-band verticals, and the off-center feed dipoles are non-resonant antennas. Enter Xian.
Enter KW.
Yes, Alan.
Years ago, there was a manufacturer that made an antenna called the Phantom Bat. They had a mystery center insulator. It looked like a dipole, it was 100 feet long, but it had a mystery center insulator. And somebody finally opened it up, and all it was a big resistor. That provided an acceptable load to the transmitter, which in turn shock excited the 100-foot antenna, which is not resonant anywhere, but certainly got out well enough over it.
Okay, but do you know what class of antenna they are?
I don't know about what class of antenna they are, but it's a non-resonant dipole.
Enter XGN.
Yes, Wesley?
I believe we start not from the right point. We should truly describe what is non-resonant antennas. So that could be a traveling wave antennas. And the configuration of the antennas whose voltage and current can be represented as one or two traveling waves moving in the same direction. So non-resonance antennas exhibit non-periodic nature. Could you add a little bit more to the progressive phase pattern associated with the voltage and the current to those antennas? Interesting.
Okay, Wesley, I assume you read that on a web page, and it's quite right. I kind of took it from last week's discussion with Alan. He was telling us about his tilted, terminated, folded dipoles, and they're not standing wave antennas either. They're very interesting antennas. They can be and have been used for the same antenna going from 3 megahertz to 30 megahertz. The reason that they have an apparent wide bandwidth is because of their loading resistor. And the entire class is called a traveling wave as opposed to standing wave. Most antennas that we hams experience are standing wave antennas. They are resonant or made resonant. They produce a standing wave on the on the radiators that slowly dissipate into electromagnetic waves that fly off into the ionosphere or ground waves and such. So they do not go back and forth. Standing waves reflect at the edges of the radiators, go back, then radiate again, and go back and develop standing waves when they're resonant. Nice, solid, stable standing waves that can dissipate into the ether. Traveling waves only travel in one direction. They go out from the feed point, they go across the wire, and then inevitably they reach a loading resistor, which is designed for a resistance of approximately the impedance. And so all of the energy left at the point that it reaches the resistor, goes into the resistor, and is dissipated as heat. And there's no reflection of current back into the element. So whatever it radiates has to be from the first time it travels to the resistor. It doesn't get a second chance. So the benefit is, since it's non-resonant, you can have a very wide bandwidth, per se. The problem, though, is because it only travels in one direction, you only get one shot, and as your frequencies of wavelength gets wider and wider, it travel in relationship to when it finally reaches up with the resistor means it'll have less and less of an opportunity to radiate. So for the T2 FD dipole that Alan mentioned, it's quoted that when it gets to around 3 megahertz, you get as much as 12 to 15 decibel of loss.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I guess I talked too much.
You got up to 3 dB of loss, so you only lost a few seconds worth.
Yeah, okay, very good. So that was the point. The point is that, and we sort of touched upon it last week, but I think I wanted to go further into it because it, to me, and some people might think it's just too academic and who cares, but, you know, sometimes YouTube indicates that people don't know what they're talking about. I was watching a YouTube where someone designed a T2FC dipole, and he said he made it modular so that he can replace it with a regular dipole element and make it a dipole antenna. And then he said what he's thinking of is putting in a traveling wave antenna element as a third option. So he was going to replace a traveling wave antenna with a traveling wave antenna, which kind of indicated he didn't know he had a traveling wave antenna. So, you know, rhombic antennas are traveling wave antennas. beverage antennas are traveling wave antennas, T2FZ are traveling wave antennas, and the antenna that Alan just mentioned are traveling wave antennas with loading resistors. And you got to be right with the amount of watts that that resistor can dissipate, because it's usually designed to take about one-third of the power output that you're feeding into that antenna.
And if anybody has a source for a non-inductive resistor, I'd like to know about it.
Well, I assume that people, if they're building them, are using carbon film. That's another point. You do not want to have any inductively designed resistors, because that, instead of just giving you pure resistance, it gives you inductance. So, but judging from YouTube, they definitely find them. I think what they tend to do is find a lot of lesser rated carbon film resistors, and they just parallel connect them to get enough current through them.
Digi.com or Mouser.com sells millions of different types of resistors, including non-inductive.
Yeah, those are great sources. Some people complain of shipping fees. I think there's a minimum with some of these companies, but they still are a bountiful source of almost everything.
I deal with them all the time. It's not free like Amazon Prime, but they are reasonable. Typically about $5 for a small item.
Oh, okay, very good. I mean, years and years ago, when I used to buy little components, for some reason, I couldn't, I didn't find them at my local Radio Shack, so I would seek out these places and get small components from them. So they're a great site. Professionals and non-professionals alike use them. You see a lot of YouTube videos where they'll even give you a list that you could take to the website and just do a quick search and pull them out into an order sheet.
And to extend.
Yes, Wesley.
Yeah, you were right. I was helping myself with the article. but I wonder, do we have the same one? That one is made by Kurt and Sturba. Non-resonance versus resonance antennas. Are we on the same page, or you use different source?
I didn't really need a source. I've kind of known about Beveridge and the other traveling wave. I mentioned traveling wave to Alan last week, but we kind of moved on and got distracted and never got around to it. So I don't have a particular source. I mean, I looked through a couple of YouTube videos for the heck of it. It's rather sad. A lot of YouTube videos for amateur radio, other than I watched our own Ed, WB2E, gave a great presentation. It was part two of his talk, and I would suggest everyone go over to YouTube after we're done tonight and watch his presentation on UHF and VHF radio technology. But with the exception of Ed, there's a lot of guys out there who are talking through things that aren't their mouths. You're getting way too much stuff wrong.
As a matter of fact, it's not exactly related, but it's related. In the article of non-resonance versus resonant antennas, the author is trying to he made this short graphical presentation when antenna is resonant, too long, too short. And what it means that it's tuned by the tuner. So I'm probably going to send it to you, but a few words about it. If the antenna is represented by the resistor of 50 ohm, then it's resonant. It's a perfect load, right? If we have the resistor connected in series with an antenna, it can be too long. But when we have resistor connected to the capacitor, which is the real part of the antenna, is capacitive in nature, then it tends to create two short antenna. But then the components of the antenna, we have a resistive component, we have an inductive component, and we have a capacitive component. And